We're going to have a few kinks today, but that's okay. Nothing major. We're going to be in Genesis 1 again this morning, so I'll let you get to looking for that. And while you're looking, I want you to be thinking about this. One of the fundamental pillars the evolutionist uses to support his position is the nature of the universe in which we live. The evolutionist says that the character of the universe gives significant evidence for their point of view. He uses a couple of things in particular: the sheer size of the universe and the fact that the universe appears to be expanding. Evolution demands an old earth and an old universe. We would say that in the face of a complete lack of evidence for anything that resembles evolution, these guys came up with the old earth theory to try and make what won't work to work. We would say that that's a compensation for a lack of evidence anywhere, that the evolutionist has done this, that has come up with this theory to explain something that we never observe, and billions and billions of years become the way to explain it all, the way to make it work. If enough time has passed, then the impossible becomes possible. And so an old universe is essential to the view of evolution. And those who hold to that faith cling to anything that seems to make the earth seem old, particularly if it seems to be billions of years. Now, the evolutionist is not willing to apply this approach even-handedly. They're not willing to look at the amount of topsoil that we have, at how much accumulates in a year with what falls to the ground and rots, plant debris, and divide the amount we have by the amount that accumulates in a given year, because if you do that, you get a young earth. So we can't do it there. Unwilling to calculate backward using topsoil. He is unwilling to use that kind of calculation, as we've talked about before, with the saltiness of the oceans. The oceans are getting saltier. As rivers flow into the ocean, they bring in salts. The water evaporates. The salt does not evaporate. And so every year there's a tiny amount more salt added to the oceans. It's a measurable amount. And if you take that amount and divide the total amount of salt by it, you get freshwater oceans 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. So the evolutionist is not willing to do that backward. You don't want to calculate that backward. If the surface of the moon accumulates cosmic dust at a predictable rate, it doesn't have an atmosphere, and so dust accumulates there on the surface of the moon. We know how much comes in a given amount of time. So when the first Apollo mission landed on the moon, they expected, with their old Earth theory, to have at least 50 feet of cosmic dust having accumulated on the moon because of their millions and millions of years they were assuming. This is why the lunar lander had those huge disks at the bottom of the landing legs. You remember seeing those in the pictures? Well, that was to stop them from sinking in the 50 feet or more of cosmic dust. And so what happens? They get to the moon and they land, and Armstrong gets out and kicks up a little dust, and it's what, about that thick? 6,000 to 8,000 years worth, as a matter of fact. And so the evolutionists are not willing to calculate backwards using the cosmic dust that's accumulated on the moon. Doesn't care to use the math on topsoil or salt or cosmic dust. They won't use it on the size of the sun. You go, but the sun is shrinking as it burns off. Go back billions of years, the sun would have been out to where Pluto is now. We don't want to do that if we're evolutionists. There are, however, other places where the evolutionist does want to calculate backward and draw conclusions from the calculations. couple of those in particular are the apparent expansion of the universe and the distance to the stars, or the size of the universe. Now, the evolutionist says the universe is expanding, it's getting bigger, that all matter is moving away from the center of the universe. Now, this is not certain by any means. So much of this stuff is so far away, you can't tell which way it's going. But, you know, there are parts of it that appear to be doing this, apparently, and so the evolutionist wants to hit the rewind button on this movement and say that if you go back billions and billions of years, all of these things that are moving away from the center would have been in one incredibly compressed mass that was the center of the universe. Now, this theory requires everlasting matter, eternal matter, pre-existent matter. But the evolutionist says that this incredibly compressed mass somehow exploded. Just use this door, guys. Just use it right here. So, this pre-existent mass exploded, and all of the stars and the planets and the comets and the moons and the asteroids and the cosmic dust and whatever else is out there is all the result of this miraculous explosion that happened with pre-existent matter billions of years ago. Now, the evolutionist does not claim to know how this event happened, how the mass got there, or what made it blow up, but he's sure it wasn't God. The theistic evolutionist says God put it there and blew it up. Well, if the universe is expanding, how do we answer this theory of this pre-existent, volatile mass from so long ago? We're going to deal with that this morning. The other big area where the evolutionist wants to calculate backward is the distance to the stars. Now, you can measure distance to something that you cannot reach by using a system called triangulation. If you remember your geometry, if you want to know how far it is to here, and you're here, you just make a triangle. And you can take an angle from this point of the baseline, take an angle from this point of the baseline, measure the baseline, calculate those angles, and if you have the right formula, you can calculate the side of the triangle so you know how far away that object is. Now, this becomes less accurate the shorter the baseline is. It's more difficult to be precise if your baseline is very short. And so, to measure the distance to the stars, the thing that you do is you deal with the Earth's orbit. You got the sun here, you got the Earth going around the sun here, and you got a star way out there you want to measure. So you take a reading in the fall over here, and then after the Earth is halfway around the sun for that year, you take another reading from there, calculate the distance across the orbit of the Earth, measure your angles to the stars, and calculate the distance. Now, this is pretty tricky stuff, because even using this distance across the orbit of the Earth, we're roughly talking about a baseline equivalent to 1 inch. Trying to calculate the distance to something that's 2, 3, 4 miles away. So we don't know exactly how far away those stars are, but some of them are pretty far away. And the evolutionist says, well, you got 6 billion light years to some of these stars. And the light from those stars would not be here yet if the Earth were not 6 billion years old. It takes several billion years to calculate for the light to travel that distance. We can measure the speed of light. We have some idea how far away the stars are, although it's hard to be real precise. And so if this star is 6.4 billion years, a billion light years away, and we can see the light, then it has to have been burning there that distance from the Earth for 6.4 billion years, or the light wouldn't be here yet. And they say that stars that are further away than the Earth is old, you can't see the light. It's not here yet. It's traveling at the speed of light, but it's not here yet because they're so far away. Well, how do we answer this? Now, clearly, there's some picking and choosing going on. You don't want to do this rewind button on things that don't support your theory, but you do want to use it on the speed of light and the distance to the stars and the expansion of the universe, if it is expanding. So clearly there's picking and choosing, but this is not an argument we can win with, because the evolutionist is just going to say, well, you're doing that too. You don't want to deal with these two questions. So are we just picking and choosing? Or are there objective answers to these pillars of evolution that we can find in the Scripture, which is the only authority that's going to make any difference anyway? Can we answer this from the Scripture? Or are we just going to have to fight them on the science, where it's my opinion versus your opinion, and who knows who's right? Or are we just picking and choosing and we don't even want to answer? Well, the truth is, we can indeed give an answer. And for our answer, we don't have to rely on our intellect, the advancements of science, our ability to interpret incredibly complex data that we don't fully understand. We don't have to rely on all of that. We do have the answers in the Scripture. And the answers to these two questions we're going to look at this morning as we consider day four. Our text is Genesis chapter 1, beginning with verse 14. Genesis 1:14, and we'll read through verse 19. It says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. There was evening and there was morning, a fourth day." Now, the answer to the questions that we've just considered is in verse 15. Let me show you that. Verse 15 again says, "And let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so." Now, in this verse lies the biblical answer to this billions and billions of light years and the time it takes for the light to travel to the earth. God created the sun and the moon and the stars to be the bearers of light for the earth. He created the light on the first day, separated the light from the darkness on the first day, but he created these heavenly bodies to give light to the earth. And the verse states that that was their purpose, and then it says, "And it was so," past tense. It was that way that day. It was so. So the light that is visible from the earth of these stars that are too far away for the light to get here in 8,000 years, the light, God created the light between here and there when he created the stars. We call this mature creation. God made things mature when he made them. When God created things, he created them in their adult appearance, on the day that he made them, the mature appearance. God did not put a star billions of light years away and then have to sit around and wait for the light to show up. He's the source of light anyway, and so he made the light between here and there, as well as the star or the planet or whatever we're looking at out there that's reflecting light. He created these things for the purpose of giving light to the earth, and so he made it where we could see it. From the first moment it was visible. Now, this idea of mature creation is not exclusive to verse 15. It's throughout the whole account. Look back at one of the verses we studied last week. Look at verse 12. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind, and trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind, and God saw that it was good. Now, the plain reading of that verse would indicate that on day three, God created fully mature plants. Trees that looked like they were hundreds of years old, and trees that looked like they were 20 or 30 years old, and they already had fruit, and they already had seed on day three. Fruit that would, in subsequent years, take a whole season to produce was hanging on the trees that day when God made the trees. And they were mature trees, because that's the kind that has fruit. So this is how God made what he made. The same is true with Adam. We'll see when we get to day six. Adam and Eve, God created Adam a mature man. Had you looked at him on day six, had you been there to look, if God let you go back in time, you would not have seen an infant waiting to grow up. He was a mature man. He would have appeared to be many years old the instant God made him. Same is true with Eve. She would have appeared to be a woman who had lived through childhood and grown into adulthood. She would have had that appearance in every way the first instant that God made her. This is how he created things. Same is true for the animals that God made. And so this is the answer to the age-old question. The chicken came first. God did not create an egg and then sit around and wait. He made the adult. In every sense. So this applies to the universe. This applies to the earth. This applies to the light that we see. Now the same issue holds true for this question of the apparent expansion of the universe, although it is by no means something that we have to take for granted. If the universe is expanding away from some theoretical central point, it's just that God gave it that appearance when he made it. It doesn't mean you can go back billions and billions of years and get a miraculous explosion without God, and you don't have to go back billions of years and get a miraculous explosion that God caused, because his word says he did it this way, not that way. So if it is expanding, then it just has that appearance. God still made it when he said he made it, the way he said he made it. He didn't have to tinker with it for the eons. He created it with the appearance that it has. Now, by the way, the whole explosion theory won't work even if you do rewind the clock. Evolutionists really hang on to this because they have to have an old Earth and an old universe. And we just need to be realistic that, you know, we don't have to believe it just because they say it. You have to understand how desperate they are to keep their theory, and without the old universe, they don't have a theory, but it won't work. Too many things are moving in opposite directions. You got all of these planets and moons orbiting whatever they're orbiting, and most of them spin on their axis in one direction. But every now and then, there's a planet or a moon that spins the other way. It's like, I'm going to turn one the other way just so nobody will think this was an accident. And beyond the differences in direction, I mean, you got comets coming this way, you got asteroids coming from every direction. You don't know when they're coming, but they'll come from anywhere. But beyond those things, I guess you could say, well, it's bouncing around. Bounced off of something, and now it's moving the other way. It made contact and reversed the spin. Okay, fine. That won't explain the precision with which all these things move. No explosion would give you the kind of precision we have in our universe. Now, again, I was a kid when we sent those guys to the moon, so it's a pretty vivid memory. I'm watching in black and white when the guy steps off onto the moon. How did they hit that thing? You know it's a moving target, right? Kennedy lays down the gauntlet in the early 60s. It takes the rest of the decade. We just get it in the 60s. We get a man up to the moon. How did we hit that thing? I mean, what if you shot them the wrong direction? I think we missed it. We're too far out now. How do we get back? Where's the moon? But people who study these things can tell you exactly where the moon is going to be on any given day because it is incredibly precise. And the same is true for all of the planets. For everything within the distance that we can measure and observe, there is this incredible precision that does not come from an explosion. When we were on vacation back in November, we happened to be camping the night of the lunar eclipse, and we hadn't even realized that this was happening. One of the other campers said, "You guys going to watch the eclipse tonight?" And we said, "Didn't know about it. It's going to start at 10:30. It'll be full by about 11:45, 12 o'clock, and it's going to go on until whatever." And he named off the times for the start, when it went total, when it started back to go across, and when it ended. He had it all. I thought, yeah, we'll watch it. So we watched it. It was awesome. And at 10:30, I look at my watch, and I look up at the moon. It's got a little dent where the shadow's starting. I'm like, well, they got that pretty good, right on the money. Right when they said it would be total, that last bit of light was gone. How do they know to the minute for the time zone we were in? I mean, they had it right. And so we came home and looked in a book, and it tells you when the next one's coming, like 8 years out or whatever, and they know what minute it'll happen then, too. This kind of thing does not come from an explosion. So we don't have to tremble before the arguments of an old universe, a pre-existent mass, the universe expanding. It doesn't work. Now let's think for a few minutes about the purpose of the lights that we have in our heavens, because what they tell us is that they're put there for a purpose. If you just observe them without having the agenda that you've got to come up with a way to explain all this without God, then they indicate there is some great design that has a purpose. What is that purpose? If they're not the aftermath of an accidental explosion, then what are they? Well, as we've seen in the rest of the account of creation, this segment is also written from the perspective of the earth. The purpose of God's creation of the sun and the moon and the stars is to give light to the earth. All of this is related to God's provision for the creatures that he's made, particularly for us as the crown of his creation. Look at verse 14. It says, "Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens." And then the purpose is stated, to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. Now this word signs does not mean occult signs for divination. A lot of people think that it does. You know, you want to look at the stars and find out what your life is going to be like. It doesn't mean that. And the Bible explicitly forbids any of that in really strong terms. So it's not that kind of sign. But it is a signpost. Navigation is possible without a global positioning system, even without a compass if you know how to read the stars. It's there for the seasons and the days and the years, just as God said. A lot of the creatures of this earth migrate in ways that we don't understand. I mean, you can't explain some of the migration patterns and how these animals know where to go, how they can find their way. The one that absolutely blows my mind is the monarch butterfly. Do you know about these things? They live in the extreme northern part of the United States and Canada. And they'll live there, and they'll lay their eggs, and more come. But at the end of the season, the ones that are born late in the season live longer than the other ones do, and they migrate to a place they've never been before. They were born there in Canada or Minnesota or somewhere like that. And they fly to Mexico for the winter. to the same places that the previous generations flew to, but that they had never been to. Now, how do they do that? I don't know. Maybe they're using these signs. They're doing something we don't understand. And God said these will be for signs and for seasons. Certainly we can use them to navigate. The sun and the moon and stars mark out our seasons. These are also a sign of something much more important, though, than whether you can find north in the dark. It's a sign of God's greatness. It's the thing that the evolutionist does not want to acknowledge. The heavens are proclaiming the greatness of God, the glory of God. Psalm 19 says, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of His hands." This is a sign to you. This is one of the things you can look at and know this didn't just happen. This is God. So, the purpose is for your seasons, for your days, for you to be able to mark things. When do we have Easter? First Sunday after the first full moon in the spring. More importantly, it's for the glory of God. It all happened just as God said on day four. Now, verses 16 through 18 have been used by those who reject the scripture to say that, well, the moon is not a light. So Moses was inaccurate. Verse 16 says, God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light to the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness, and God saw that it was good. So some folks will look at this and say, well, you know, the moon does not actually generate its own light. And they conclude from that that the Bible is inaccurate. You know, this is a mistake. Moses misspoke. He made a scientific blunder. He thought that it was a light, but it's just this dark hunk of dirt up there reflecting the sun's light. And so, you know, we probably just need to edit this. And we can just, you know, discount just the parts that are inaccurate and submit just those parts to science as we learn more about the universe. Moses just didn't know. And so we'll submit the Bible to the wisdom of men at this point. Well, what's the answer to that little disagreement? Is it inaccurate? Did Moses make a mistake? Did he not have enough science growing up in Egypt? What?
It's still a bearer of light, just in a different sense.
Okay. It's a bearer of light, but it's a different sense. Yeah, the moon's not on fire. But when you look up there, do you see light? Yeah. We got one firefighter in the room. Is it possible to be in the fire and it be dark? No? All that smoke? Well, I'll work on that illustration again then. Remember that in Revelation, God says that He's going to darken the sun but leave it in place. Do you remember when we talked about that? Revelation 6:12 says, "And I looked when He broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood." So if you want to talk about it in the strictest sense, the sun is not a light either. Now, it looks like one. It is on fire, but, or at least we think it's on fire. Nobody's actually been there. But God's going to turn the light off when that sixth seal is opened. The sun's still going to be there. I mean, how else would it be black as sackcloth when you looked at it if it's not there? So none of the heavenly bodies generates its own light, not one. God is the light. And the answer to the little argument is back in verses 3 and 4. On the first day, it says, God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. What he did on day four was take the light that he had already made and assign it to these different heavenly bodies. Some of them are planets that look like stars, if you just look with your eyes. Some of them are stars, although we don't really know what they are. They're so far away. Moons that reflect light. But all of them, they're bearing the light that God assigned them. And in that sense, they are lights. So Moses is not misstating scientific fact here. And God has not made a mistake in his revelation. These are lights. The verse 16 is not intended to be a discourse on the ultimate source of the light, because that's already covered in verses 3 and 4. God is the source. Now verse 16 also speaks of a greater light to govern the day and a lesser light to govern the night. We take this to be the sun and the moon. Science has shown us that there are probably stars much larger than the sun. And the moon is just small. For anything that stays up there, it's small. But these are called two great lights in verse 16, and people trip over this. Now, what's your answer? Is there an inaccuracy in Scripture? The moon's small. The sun's small for a star. And how do you answer this? Well, why does it call them two great lights then, in comparison to these other things that are not big?
The Earth is the center of the biblical universe. In comparison, they shed much more light than any other star.
That's right. You know, and if you've got somebody who's really just wants to understand it, you know, they're kind of trying to figure it out. They're not caustic and antagonistic and ridiculing your point of view. They're just saying, well, why does it say this? That's the answer. This whole account is written from the perspective of the earth. And, you know, all of this is here for us, for our pleasure, for our benefit, for our provision. And so from here, the two biggest lights in the sky are the sun and the moon. One that you see in the day, one that you see primarily at night. So that's right. Now, you know, if you're dealing with a scoffer, that's not going to do, but nothing is going to do. If you're dealing with somebody who's genuinely trying to figure it out, that's the answer. All right, with the time we have left, I want to open a can of worms. You ready? Are you feeling feisty? Is the evolution doctrine anti-people? Yes, okay, tell me why.
Because it assigns people to the same place of any other thing. There's no real reason to differentiate between a person and any other matter. Everything's a matter anyway. And the only reason we're different is by chance.
All right, that's a good answer. So this point of view is anti-people because it diminishes us. We are not made in the image of God. We're just one more critter, just matter, just stuff. And that means there's no future beyond this life. There's no God that we are made by or communicating with or made in the image of. Well, that's right. That's right. That's right. Can you name another reason that you would say, or maybe you don't agree, but if you know, is evolution anti-people? And if you agree, why? Or how is it?
Because, you know, they're saying that animals are just
So I don't have to
respect.
I don't have to respect you. You're just you're just an accident anyway, right?
But we must respect animals.
Yeah. Now, we talked a few weeks ago, and it was late in the time, and we kind of ran out of time. I drew you the pictures of the people who were either bent over or who had a certain... I'm not going to draw four of you again, so quit laughing back there. You remember in the science books, the shapes of the skull, and I told you how in my science class, as we were talking about this, the person in our class who had a skull shaped like that happened to be of African descent. Evolution is anti-non-white people. I don't know if you know it, but Darwin's book originally had a subtitle. And I can't remember the exact wording, but it was to prove the superiority of the white race. I don't know if you know it, but Hitler, who was a big evolutionist, filed an official protest at the 1930 whatever it was Olympics because his men were having to compete against those animals, and that's not fair. It is anti-non-white people. The whole basis of evolution was, or one of the primary motivations, was to prove the superiority of the white race. And you might want to bring this up if you're ever debating this. Well, are you saying white people are the best, most evolved people? Because that's what Darwin was saying. He was saying the black people were animals, the brown people were a little closer, but only the white people were people. Now, that's just wrong. You can't hold that view and not hate people. And then what Ann pointed out is the one that just kills me. You know, they want to say a rat is a boy, is a dog, or whatever that saying is that's famous. I can't remember the rest of the quote. You're just like all those other things. But there is astounding inconsistency in this view. If you believe in survival of the fittest, then, dear ones, we are the fittest. Kill and eat. You know the joke, what all endangered species have in common? They taste great. Chandler? Well, see, that's what I'm saying. It's completely inconsistent. The evolutionists all want to push this animal rights stuff. The evolutionists tell you to deny every tenet of their faith. If we're the fittest, we have earned the right to decimate this planet. And we're the fittest. There's no critter we can't hunt, kill. We could eradicate it. We can eat whatever we want. But the evolutionists would have you deny the faith of evolution, and they say, don't reproduce. There are too many people. They're big into birth control. They're big into homosexuality because that doesn't reproduce anything, and there's too many people. And people are bad for the planet. Don't kill in order to eat meat because other animals have rights. Why do they have rights? Well, because they're not as fit as you. It's too easy for you to kill them. They have to be protected from you because they're not the fittest. Okay, well, why can't I kill and eat? Don't use the natural resources that God provided on this planet for your own survival. You don't have any right to do it. Other species may be impacted. Well, now, wait a minute. I thought the fit ones were supposed to survive. If you believe in evolution, you should say, so what? Let them die. They're not strong enough to live. We don't need them. Time to thin the herd. We went to the Tennessee Aquarium Monday, and we heard all day how bad people are. The last lady almost got a speech from me. I was just this close to saying, is there nobody here who believes in God? Do they make you say this to work here? I know they're not paying them. They're all volunteers. So they, you know, they make you say this. People are not evil. They're not that way anyhow. You watch the PBS shows. If a crocodile kills a zebra, They'll show you over and over again. You seen that one? What is the crocodile for killing the zebra? He is a predator honed to perfection over millions and millions of years of evolution. If you kill a zebra, you're evil. In fact, if you kill a crocodile, you're evil. You can't kill rattlesnakes. You're evil. This view is rooted in a hatred for people. Now, where does that come from? Why? What motivates this hatred for other people? For people who are not like us, the non-white people. For people in general, we shouldn't reproduce, we shouldn't eat, we shouldn't survive. What motivates this hatred?
A debased mind.
A debased mind?
Romans 1.
Yeah. Romans 1 says, they worship and serve created things rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Have you noticed the worshipful wording? The crocodile honed to perfection as a predator through millions and millions of years of... The crocodile has developed a strategy for getting the zebra in the river where the crocodile is strong and the zebra is not as... It's worship, folks. And that is one of the reasons. Can you think of any other reasons? What does God say to Adam and Eve? What is their purpose? One of the things he says. Fill the earth, be fruitful, and multiply. Another reason for this hatred of man that is, at least right now, found its home in this evolution movement is rebellion against God in a direct sense. God said, fill the earth, be fruitful, and multiply. And so these guys say there are too many people. Why? Why do you think there are too many? It's not that the earth can't support twice as many, four times as many. The earth will support many times more than the people who are here, even now. Well, it's because God said it'd be great if the earth was full. Fill it up. Well, we can't agree with God, and so we have to take the other position.
So the Tower of Babel, where they refused to be scattered from
that one place. That's right. They were working against God's purposes, and this is one of the motivators. There's one more I want to show you. And all of these kind of come under the heading of what Nathan said. It's a perverse mind. It's the fallen mind. But there are particular motivations within that fallenness. And this direct rebellion against God is one of them. God said, fill the earth, be fruitful, and multiply, so people exalt any way to avoid that. Look at Titus 3:3, please. Titus 3:3 says, for we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts and pleasures, spending our life in malice and envy, hateful, hating one another. Now this is just one of the descriptions in Scripture that sort of gives us the idea of this fallen mind that Nathan mentioned. But notice what it says at the end of the verse. Two characteristics. Hateful, hating one another. It's inherent in the sinful mind to hate. God is love. Sinners hate. And so it is just in the nature of the sinfulness that's in all of us. We have the capacity to hate. But if we indulge our sin and if we exalt our sin against God more and more, then the hatred comes out more and more. And so those who are the most sold out to this evolution stuff tend to have the most hatred that is expressed outwardly toward other people. To them, you have no right to survive, even though you're the fittest, and all these other inconsistencies. And we can worship the animals and exalt them and lift them up and call them wise for selecting these ways to survive instead of calling God wise for creating them so wonderfully. Now, our perspective is a challenging one because we can know all of this. Our job is not to defeat anyone. It's not to beat them into submission and make them feel stupid for ever having brought it up. Although we probably have the firepower to do that. We don't need to do that. So the challenge for us is to be merciful, to be kind, but not to compromise the truth. Now that's a delicate thing, isn't it? You got the truth. You're not caving in on it. You need to express it, but you always need to keep the perspective. And this verse gives us that too. It says, "For we also once were foolish ourselves." You know where you'd be if God hadn't intervened in your life. You might be an evolutionist. You might be a lost monotheist, going to a liberal church every week and bound for hell. There's a lot of ways to be foolish, and this radical evolutionist movement is just one of the ways to be foolish, but we'd all be there somewhere in that foolishness had God not intervened. And so we need to approach people with that perspective. We kind of talk bluntly here, and sometimes you have to be blunt with other people, but you always want to do it with a measure of grace, particularly if they're not there yet. You know, we'd be right there with them. And we used to be foolish, whatever our brand of foolishness was. We used to be. So we keep that perspective, but we have to tell the truth. And the truth is that the evolution doctrine is antithetical to what God has revealed about himself. It is an outright rebellion against him. It is extremely willful. It goes against all sense because of that willful rebellion. The truth is, everything was created for God's glory and for our benefit. All of these things, the sun and the moon and the stars that we looked at today, the plants that we looked at last week, the animals that are coming, all of it was for us. We don't have to bow to the evolutionist and we don't have to cave in on this truth. But I'm really thankful I didn't bark at the lady at the Tennessee Aquarium. I don't think it would have been productive. Sometimes you just get so stirred up. You got to remember, if it wasn't for God's grace, you'd be right there with them. And they need to see the love that God has put in you, along with hearing the truth. So I'll leave you with that. Let me close this in prayer.